Hi, I'm Jay from JinxNavigator.com, and this is my podcast. We're making our way through all of the issues of the Jinx. That was a newsletter for magicians and mentalists that lasted from 1934 to 1941, and a lot of what we do as mystery performers can be traced back to something from the Jinx. This is the podcast where we browse through every issue and find out how many of the ideas are still usable. Spoiler alert, the answer is just about all of them. We're looking at issue number 22 today, which contains Numero by Al Baker, the editorial from Theodore Annemann, business cards and notes of the notables from Theodore Annemann, a question of power from L. Vosburgh Lyons, the card phenomenon by Audley Walsh, and here's your change, Lou Brent. Quick thing before we move on, I was building a set list in Headliner last night and it flagged that one of my effects wasn't quite show ready, which saved me from finding that out in front of an audience. That sounds like something you'd find handy. Check out Headliner at mysterycreators.com. Issue number 22 opens at the IBM convention in New York, where Annemann has just returned from. The IBM apparently bought up the town, as usual, and got more newspaper coverage in the Buffalo and Rochester papers than any other magical organization had managed. Annemann is puzzled that more Eastern magicians don't attend, and quotes one club president who said he wouldn't go because he didn't like the class of people there. From there, he makes an argument that reads like a recurring theme in the Jinx. One good trick can make a magician's career, and it's almost never a new one. He runs through a list of working performers of the era, each one identified with a single signature effect. Cardini with his manipulative act, Tommy Martin with an egg and fan, Jero with bills and a lemon, Judd Cole inseparable from Kling Klang, Fred Keating in the Birdcage, Gully Gully with baby chicks under cups, Mogul with a single billet reading, Russell Swan with the sun and moon. His point is that every one of them went back into older literature and found something nobody was doing and built a reputation on it. He tells readers to dig into magic publications from 1900 to 1920 and use their heads. A quick candle lighting idea follows, a simple bit of business usable as a quick interlude anywhere a candle appears in the act. There's also a legal item worth noting. A letter from attorney Jacob Steisel describes successfully stopping the unauthorized mimeographing and sale of the Colostro Mind Reading Act by contacting the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Department of Justice. The result? A government contact, a firm warning, and no further unauthorized copies. Steisel's position is that this approach, going directly to federal authorities, would quickly clean up the piracy problem if applied consistently across the field. Annemann prints it as a practical model for anyone in a similar situation. The convention dispatches continue. Bob Geisel of Toledo, the burglar from Toledo, was offered the key to the city and declined it, noting he didn't need a key. He spent the convention's late hours picking the locks of other attendees' rooms, entering and walking back out again. When a group inside locked and bolted their door against him, he got through twice. Annemann reports that Max Holden hadn't been seen to laugh that hard in 10 years. Other brief items from the editorial, Hardeen, Martin Sunshine, and Jim Collins have headed to Fort Worth to work the fair with Svengali decks. A performer named Kondo is apparently touring vaudeville with a complete steal of Jack Gwynn's act. And Francis Finneran lost his entire act in the subway. This one is called Numero. It's from Al Baker, and Annemann's introduction describes it as one of those effects with an anticlimax that somehow becomes greater because of it. Here's what an audience experiences. A helper is handed a folded slip of paper, a prediction to hang on to. The performer shows a large slate and asks the helper to write a row of figures across it, as many as come to mind. The performer adds a second row, the helper adds a third, and the performer finishes with two more rows quickly. A line is drawn underneath, and the helper adds up the total. They read it aloud. They open the prediction slip. Yes, the total is correct. So that's the first surprise. Then the performer explains there's something more. He shows the back of the slate, which has the alphabet written out with a number assigned to each letter. He asks the helper's name. Matching the digits of the total to the letters on the chart, the helper's own name spells out from the numbers they helped assemble. Baker's preparation involves knowing the helper's name in advance, converting it to numbers using the chart, and using a variant of the classic 9 principle to control the total while leaving room for the helper's apparently free contributions. The whole thing works with nothing more than a slate, chalk, and a piece of paper. Full details, including the letter-to-number chart, can be found at jinxnavigator.com. The next two items in this issue are a page of business cards from back in the day and newspaper clippings from back in the day. You can inspect both of those at jinxnavigator.com. Just look for issue number 22. Dr. L. Vosburgh-Lyon brings us a question of power, and he opens by saying, without fear of contradiction, that what follows is a new and different way of revealing chosen cards. Three helpers each select a card and return it to the deck. The performer holds the deck with the backs facing the audience. Top card is turned to show it is not one of the chosen ones, it's a joker. It's turned back. Someone names their card, the deck is snapped, and the top card is turned again. It's the named card. The joker is gone. This happens three times. Each person names their card in turn. Each time the snap produces exactly the right one. And at the end, the performer remarks that if no one had named a card, the original card shown at the start would still be there, and turns the top card over one last time to prove it, the Joker is back. And then the deck is free for any further effects. The mechanics involve a duplicate Joker and a series of steals from the back of the deck, timed to happen while the performer is speaking and attention is off the deck. Lyons notes that he usually argues one repetition is enough for most effects, but here, three times is exactly right. Full details on this at jinxnavigator.com. This one is from Audley Walsh, and the card phenomenon is a spelling effect with a twist that Walsh describes as baffling even to magicians who already know the standard addition principle underneath it. The performer turns his back. A helper counts off any number of cards, up to about a dozen, into a pile, and he pockets them. He deals a second pile about the same size, shuffles it, notes the bottom card, and replaces the packet on top of the deck. The performer turns back around, explains the procedure for spelling, and demonstrates with a card of his own choosing, spelling it off the deck and showing the next card. He picks up those spelled off cards, replaces them. The helper now takes the pocketed cards, puts them on top, and names his card for the first time. He spells it out one card per letter, and the next card after the last letter is the one he noted. The setup involves 14 cards placed in a specific position in the deck. The mathematical relationship between the helper's count, the demonstration spelling, and the final position locks everything into place, regardless of how many cards were dealt. Walsh notes that the performer never knows the card or the number, and that that point alone tends to confuse people who think they've spotted the method. Full details on the card phenomenon at jinxnavigator.com. This last effect in issue number 22 is from Lou Brent. Here's your change? Yes, with a question mark on the end. And it's a coin routine built around a premise that's hard to resist. The performer borrows a half dollar and, while apparently demonstrating how coins can travel from place to place, ends up producing a handful of loose change instead. So the coin passes from hand to knee to hand. On the last transfer, when the left hand is open, it contains 3 nickels and a quarter, 40 cents. Something went astray. The performer reaches behind the right knee and produces the missing dime, and both hands are shown empty. The half dollar has made its way quietly into a pocket during the moment of surprise when the change appears, and Brent notes that the misdirection at that moment is about as clean as it gets. Everyone's looking at the change, counting it, reacting to the surprise. His closing observation is worth passing along. A quick coin sequence like this, presented as seemingly casual byplay before a formal routine begins, often impresses people more than the main trick. It gives the impression that the performer can do something at any moment with any object. Full details at jinxnavigator.com. That's it for this episode of the Jinx Navigator podcast. To see every article in every issue of the Jinx, go to jinxnavigator.com and sign up, and it is completely free. Use the contact form on that site. Let me know what you think of the podcast, good, bad, or indifferent. I'm Jay Jennings from jinxnavigator.com. And I hope you join me again next time when we explore issue number 23, which includes Dr. Jacob Daly and his death divination. And I thank you in advance for helping spread the word about this, the Jinx Navigator podcast. See you next week.